so for this evening's Dhamma talk. It's quite surprising, maybe not, that things happen during the week and little things come up the last couple of days, which, first of all, I didn't know what I was going to talk about this evening, but that we were talking a little bit just the last couple of days in the monastery at a house dhamma today and just in the office, and just remember this was very important for something happening tomorrow about even the royal wedding. Sorry to bring that up again, those people are fed up with it. But it was all about something in Buddhism, which is one of the things we're supposed to abandon and let go of to become the first stage of enlightenment, to become a streamwind and so on. In Pali, many of you may know that, it's called Silabhata Paramasa, which is like the attachment to the idea that rules and rites and rituals can be a way to enlightenment, to freedom, to peace. And it just brings to mind that at those weddings, it's amazing just how much protocol, how things have to be arranged to the second, and how you have to do it this way and you can't do it that way, and just how much ceremony is involved in something as simple as just a wedding. And it's also, people say, well, why do we just have to bow and do chanting when we come to a Buddhist center? You know, why are the monks sitting up here with these brown robes and bald heads? You know, what's the purpose of all this? You know, all these rules and rites which the monks have to keep. Why is it that you can't hug a monk? And if you're a female, then you know, the reason should be pretty obvious to you, that you know that some people have communicable diseases. You know, I have this baldness, which stick around me long enough and you become bald too. Many people have done that, they become monks and nuns. And as I was saying to a few people, that I have been diagnosed with this incurable disease called hepatitis. Hepatitis B. Not hepatitis, hepatitis. You might catch that. But why do we have rules and regulations like this? And why do things have to be done in a certain way? I don't know why people actually said this. They thought I was going to be invited to the royal wedding. But anyone who's participated in a wedding where, you know, I give the blessing, you should know exactly why I will never ever get invited to a wedding like that. Because part of my wedding blessing is to not just sprinkle, but to drench people with holy water. And I think Dennis, where's he gone? He's hiding again. Oh, Dennis had to my view of God. Dennis would know. And those of you who've watched marriage celebrations by me know just how much holy water I sprinkle people with. And imagine if I got invited to that royal wedding, that, you know, I'd give those two couples such a drenching. Because isn't it supposed to be like a happy occasion? Why do we have like these rules and rituals, these rites and ceremonies? You know, can we do it with more simplicity? And even like funeral ceremonies, departed relations ceremonies. Next week, Waisak ceremony. Why do we have so much ceremonies, you know, in religions? And even just, it took me a long time to understand, just why do you have a religious part to a wedding ceremony? Isn't that something very worldly? Why do you invite monks, especially monks like me who've never been married, to bless weddings? And it took me a while to understand that even just when you commit to a partner, just, you know, one-on-one, there is something which is spiritual about that. And it took me a long time to understand why. You know, do people just want a monk like myself or somebody to be there at their wedding. And it is because even at a wedding, there is a sense of renunciation. Renouncing just all other people and committing to one person. And it's not an easy thing to do. You know, because men and women, they have their desires, and they might see somebody which really excites them. But, you know, they say, no, I put my battery here. I'm not going to cross that line. I have to renounce what I would like to do. You know, my hormones sort of keep telling me to do, because I'm going to commit to one person. It is an act of renunciation. And so many, many men and women come up to me and say, well, you know, just should I, shouldn't I? And some just do cross that line, and it does cause them a lot of problems and difficulties. But, you know, that sometimes that we have to do that renunciation. Otherwise, it's just caused more problems. It tells us we have a ceremony like that because, you know, of all people, like monks, should be the experts in renunciation. You know, because we have to renounce a lot. We should be, and hopefully that we can do that. So we can teach by example, hopefully, just the fact that we can to say no to things which we might want to do, but which don't make any sense. And little things. One of the times when I first knew the power of letting go was when I just decided to give up alcohol. And this was in UK. All my friends were drinking. And I thought this would weaken me, but as soon as I made a decision, I'm going to renounce. I didn't see any point in it, basically. And as soon as I decided to say no to it, I felt this great surge of energy. And I was making a decision, you know, not to follow what other people were doing, but to actually not to follow customs, but to actually to understand what these things were and to make a choice. Make a choice. It would be difficult to, you know, to see. But I like drinking with my friends and having a beer or having some wine or something. But then I decided, no, I'm not going to do this. It's amazing the sense of power which you have making a decision. And also just how much that was respected by my friends. Because it was only afterwards, and I asked them, what do you think about all of that? You know, when I decided to, you know, not take alcohol. And they said, we respected your strength. You made a decision. We may not agree with it, but, you know, you did that. You didn't sort of try and convert other people and tell us not to drink. But, you know, that's what you did yourself. And I thought that was actually something which was very important. That's why we have, like, little rules and rituals. Because it does actually make us feel stronger. We're not just going with the ways other people do. We're making a stand, a moral stand, what we decide we think is good, what we think is right. And that gives us lots of integrity, lots of inner strength, and also just lots of feeling of just well-being, emotional, spiritual well-being, when you just decide to go your path, your journey, and not just do what other people say. And so sometimes you have to stand up for those things, and sometimes it does wound you, bruise you, but you decide, no, I need to do this. So, just on those little things like precepts, why do we even have to have those precepts? Because you know, we're taking those on Waisak Day, for those who knew Buddhists, and look, for me it's like, why not? To me it was just common sense. And I was just talking in the in the car on the way here, that, you know, people say, well, why can't you just participate in the world, be like other people? But then sometimes, do I want to be like other people? Or do I really want to just, you know, have this great sense of truth to myself, to do what I think is a very good thing to do? And so sometimes it takes a lot of renunciation just to be a good human being. To actually to resist what other people want you to do, to resist things like consumerism. Yeah, of course, every now and again you think, oh, wouldn't it be nice you know, to go on a holiday somewhere overseas, to go to Bali, but not to give a talk, to rest by the beach, enjoy some nice sun with nothing to do in the whole world. But I think, you know, that's what other people do. But is that really what you want to do? And it's all the problems involved in that. Just, you know, let alone just the carbon emitted by aircraft, and just, you know, what are you doing that for? Can't you really relax and enjoy yourself here? Simple, in simplicity, instead of like consuming so much. So a lot of times that, you know, that people do make a stand and they feel better for it. One of the most important things in making a stand, a moral stand, is that, you know, to please don't criticize other people who can't do that, who don't do that, because that just makes you just so radical. One of the worst things which I ever felt was, you know, I was a vegetarian for many years when I was at college, and I remember a girlfriend, she invited me for dinner, and at the dinner, she somehow forgot. She made me a curry with meat in it. And I just really said, "Why you got that for me? I'm not eating that." And of course, that was the end of that relationship. Of course, some of you think that's a good thing. That was the end of that relationship because I might not become a monk. But I looked back upon that and I thought, what a just a nasty thing which I did. You know, I should at least been kind to her, maybe ate it. She put so much energy and effort into doing that. And I would say, "Oh, next time, you know, please remember that, you know, I didn't eat that stuff." But whatever you do, you have to have some letting go, some renunciation. But when it comes to some ceremonies, it is makes it stronger, the commitment together, when you do things together in front of family and friends with some sort of rite or ritual. But it's one of the reasons which I say, one of the stories I say at weddings, and I probably, if I did get invited to a royal wedding, I'll probably mess it up by saying this story. And I say, before you are married, when you're engaged, even living together, it is just called involvement. It's not commitment yet until you put the rings on. I did put those rings on. Once you got those rings on, we call it a commitment. And it's a difference between bacon and eggs. Must be a long time since I told this story. You haven't read Opening the Door of Your Heart for a while because it's in there. Like, what's bacon and eggs got to do with a wedding? And the solution is, the answer is, in bacon and eggs, the pig is committed. The chicken is only involved. Come on. In other words, the chicken just gives an egg and walks away. The pig gets his whole life. It's a metaphor of, you know, whether you're in it for, you know, full on, you really commit to something, or you just do it half-heartedly. And so that when we do a ceremony, by having other people around, by doing it, you know, in a way which is in front of others, it does actually reinforce the sense of commitment. You're giving it more. And that's also with even like funeral services and all the stuff which goes around that. By having a service, by doing a ceremony, it actually does make it just feel just more, it gives a bigger imprint into your mind. I do remember Ajahn Chah, just when he was doing a blessing service for this poor Westerner marrying to a Thai girl, and he made the Westerner sit for a long time, just, you know, in the formal position, you know, which is Thai people know, it's just you know, one leg without any cushions, and this poor Western guy, he was really suffering, he was in pain. And then said, "What are you doing that for? You know, why do I have to sit like this for an hour listening to chanting in Pali and a sermon in Thai, which I don't know what the heck's going on?" And Ajahn Chah just got someone to explain it to him. He said, we want to make this a memorable occasion. It's memorable because it's hurting. Yes. So you'll never even think about going through a marriage again. Just keep to this girl and no one else. You're just making a memorable occasion. But of course, it's just reinforcing sort of why you are doing something. Even just talking today at a little ceremony we were doing about why monks do chanting and blessing, and you know, even the holy water. Why can't anybody else get some water and just sprinkle it over people? And it's not really the ceremony, it's just the meaning you put into it. So if you understand what you're doing and why you're doing it and put that energy into it, it makes those ceremonies really quite powerful. Whether it's a marriage ceremony, making it powerful, blessing of someone who's just had a kid. Now they want to sort of celebrate it, even just you know, bring it up to sort of like a monk or a priest, is just basically to get to know one another. And this is an important thing, because I do remember this lady who was over in, her husband was working in Saudi Arabia and brought her kid. Actually, before she brought her kid, she came to Bodhinyana Monastery. She was pregnant and she asked me to sort of, have you got some like talks and CDs and stuff and books, because in Saudi Arabia she was not allowed to work herself. So she was at home all day doing nothing because her husband was working hard and she couldn't work. And so she spent so much time while she was pregnant listening to my talks. And of course, when she was listening, guess who else was listening? Because I remember, I can just recall it in my mind right now, when she gave birth and she brought her kid to Bodhinyana Monastery, she brought it in, it was just in her arms, and she was just, the kid was just pretty much sort of not looking, paying attention. But as soon as I started speaking, the kid looked up straight away, recognized me. Because he'd been listening to my talks all that time. So brainwashing can start at a very young age, and it's good brainwashing, because the kid was nice and peaceful and quiet. People have actually told me that, and some research even being done on that. If people, when they're pregnant, if they can like meditate even, and just, you know, listen to some nice calm talks, positive reinforcement, they usually, the kids turn out to be very, you know, reasonably peaceful children. You know, the first years of their life, they don't tend to sort of cry and worry so much, because they've got that influence from some of the very early times of their life. So some of this chanting is very, very helpful. But it's actually why you're doing this. And I often tell people that, you know, some of these rules, rites and rituals which monks do, you know, one of the things which we often do is just go to people's houses to get rid of bad spirits, the ghost busting. And I really love that stuff, because that's really exciting stuff, to get a ghost and send it away. But, you know, it's what you're doing it for. And I was telling somebody, you know, today, or a couple of days ago, so it's last night, I don't even remember, that fellow who was asking about getting rid of spirits from the house. And telling him that I went to this house over here in Perth, and they had some sort of spirit which was messing around in the house. These things exist. Okay, I'm going to go on a sideline here, a true story. But there was one fellow, he was here just a month ago, that's why I remember him. And he, because I was talking, said, just, you know, jog my memory, did this actually happen? I said, oh yeah, it happened. There were these two English men. They came out some time ago on, I think there may have even been the old £10 pomps, you know, cheap fare, and they came out and they were sharing a house together, good friends, and one of them was like, love playing practical jokes. And would always do, you know, little things. And unfortunately, he got cancer, and incurable, and he died. But before he died, he'd tell his friend, "I'll still play practical jokes on you after I've died." And he did. And he was in the house for quite a long time. And his friend, he couldn't see him, but his wife sometimes saw him. But, you know, he was still playing practical jokes. First of all, you know, silly things, like he was having a shower, and then the hot water went off, and it was only cold water, boo, and then it went back again. And then it was doing things like turning the TV channel over, just like another couple over here. They had the TV channel, they kept on turning over from one channel to another channel. And they thought there was something wrong with the remote control, but there's nothing wrong with the remote control. They found out it was actually a ghost in the house, and they asked, you know, what can we do about this? The solution is obvious. I don't see why people can't just, you know, think sort of straight instead of think through fear. And so what they did, they bought another TV set. And one is for the ghost and one is for them. So the ghost can watch whatever he wants. And their channel is just, you know, doesn't interfere. It's obvious. But in this house, the ghost was a really bit upset. Oh no, to this other fellow. That this fellow, as soon as he came to this house, this guy who was here a couple of weeks ago, I can't really say his name. But anyway, that he came to the house and telling the story, said, "Oh, I don't believe in this. You know, if he's really still around, let's see something." So he challenged, you know, the ghost to actually do something. And, you know, he said, and it happened. They had a pot plant on the table. They're having a cup of coffee together. "Oh, there's a ghost around, come on, do something." And a leaf fell off the pot plant and it travelled horizontally, which was weird, and then fell down vertically, half on, half off the edge of the coffee table. And this fellow said, "Ah, that's just coincidence, you know. Leaves fall off every now and then." Another one fell off, horizontal, down, and fell right on top of the first leaf, matched perfectly. "Ah, that's a coincidence, I don't believe." Another one fell off. And I often say here that things are done three times in Buddhist tradition. So another one fell off, went the same trajectory, not sort of up and down, but horizontal, then straight down, perfectly on top of the first two. And at that, this visitor never argued. He didn't finish his coffee. He was out of the door as fast as he could. He ran away. He didn't tell me the story. It actually happened. He saw it. But anyway, so... You know, sometimes that we went, I remember just going to this house, and another house which had some problems, and they had all these other people try to exorcise the ghost, and they say it got worse, and it's obvious. You know, just rites and rituals, just, you're trying to get rid of somebody who thinks they want to live there. So why not live there? So we did, instead of exorcism chanting, we did just, "May you be happy and well in this house" chanting. To placate the ghost, the house is big enough for all of us. So you look after one another. And just that's what they did, and the problem was solved. So, you know, sometimes the rites and rituals, if you don't know what you're doing and why you're doing it, of course you cause problems. You get the marriage ceremonies. Why are you doing that? You know, you want to commit to one another, or at least give it a try. Divorce rituals. Do we do divorce ceremonies? Unfortunately, they're held not in temples, but in lawyers' offices. Which is, why do they actually do that? Can they actually, why not we can do, instead of, you know, this rites and rituals, it has to be done in a negative way, why can't we do a ceremony here? To say, well, you know, we've tried it out, we've, you know, done our very best, and so... Can we do a little ceremony here in the temple to say, well, you know, we respect one another, ask forgiveness of one another, and just depart, you know, in with some amicability? Why do we always have to do things in one way? Now, that is what the problem with what they call Sila Bhatta Paramasa, the attachment to rites and rituals, saying it has to be done one way. and it can't be done another way. You're doing it wrong. You shouldn't do it that way. You should do it my way, or the way of our tradition. Have to be done this way. And that sometimes that causes a lot of problems because you're not adapting. You've got no freedom to actually to take a really good ceremony and move it this way and that way according to the time and place. So it is good to have some little ceremonies of commitment. But if we don't know what we're doing it for, it can be totally counterproductive, and it means that people don't get the benefits of these, you know, these wonderful little traditions. And just, you know, one of those traditions is this beautiful, what we call the forgiveness ceremony, which, you know, often love to do at weddings and also at funerals. It would be wonderful if we could do that forgiveness ceremony at divorces. Because what it is we look at one another and say, there's bound to be some things which I have done by body, speech or mind, or didn't do, which upset you. What it is first of all acknowledging that no one is right, we all make mistakes, no one is perfect, and that we want to sort of acknowledge that sometimes we may have hurt you or harmed you, or sometimes not just because we meant to, but because, you know, we're human beings, and sometimes that things we never really meant to be offensive sometimes did hurt you. And that forgiveness ceremony is a very beautiful, beautiful ceremony. I remember doing that once after a trip, you know, through India, through visiting the holy places over there. And of course, you know, it's always uncomfortable, it's difficult, it's tiring, but it can be inspiring. And just the last day before we got on the aircraft to go back to Perth and just to go our separate ways, and you can't do this when you arrive in Perth because people are so tired, they just want to get back home as soon as possible. And so just the last day, the last night, we had a little forgiveness ceremony, which was very beautiful. And we led people in saying, if there's anything which we have done by body, that's action, by speech, or by even thought, which may have hurt each other, or if there's anything we didn't do, which we should have done, we ask forgiveness. And we always give that forgiveness. That's an important part of the ceremony, to trust in the power of, yes, we forgive you. And it was a very beautiful ending to that ceremony. It's one of the reasons why people, they went to all these places in India, you know, which places of pilgrimage, were supposed to be inspiring. Well, actually, we try to actually to live those teachings, not just to visit monuments of the past, but to actually to take some of what was taught there and bring it into just our own, just personal interactions. And you know that, back to weddings again, that I did do a celebrity wedding once, and it went into Hello magazine in Malaysian edition. It's the only time I've ever been in Hello magazine as a feature. Because it was I'm not sure if she's ever listening, she still tunes in every now and again, but I thought I saw her at a distance in Singapore Airport when I was off to Medan, and she was off somewhere else, so we passed in Singapore Airport, but there's too much of a distance, and I was going for my flight, so I couldn't really stop. But she had her own TV show, Sandria her name was, her own TV show, and she was listening to, no, it's a model as well. She was getting married, and she thought, she'd listened to Ajahn Brahm's teachings, so, wouldn't it be wonderful if I can get him to come to do our blessing for our wedding? And it just so happened she was going to do her wedding in her hometown, which was Malacca, on the west coast of West Malaysia. And she went there, and it just so happened the temple had a sign out, Ajahn Brahm coming to give a talk exactly the same day that she planned her wedding. And so she was so amazed. So she managed to get my email or something, or this place's email, and said, just be wonderful if you can come to our wedding. And it fat in perfectly. You know, the afternoon was free enough, so I went to do her wedding ceremony. And the one thing which which she really remembered. And when I saw her later on, a few years later, I said, she said, "Yeah, I'm still doing this." She said, "Every year on the your anniversary, which is another little ceremony, you know, the anniversary of your wedding, just get a little present for each other, nothing expensive. Doesn't matter who starts, and just quietly just say to one another, if it's, give the little present, and if there's anything which I have done by body, speech or mind in the last 12 months which has hurt you, which has offended you, irritated you, intentional or just by accident, or anything I didn't do which I should have done which has upset you, I sincerely ask your forgiveness. Please forgive me." You say it with meaning, and then you give the little gift over, and then the other person does the same. Anything which I have done, body, speech or mind, intention or unintention, which has hurt you, please, honestly, I ask forgiveness. I'm not perfect, but I'm trying. I'm committed to you. And then they forgive one another. And I know that because that she said in a little Hello magazine, she said that was one of the most meaningful parts of the ceremony, the forgiveness ceremony. It wasn't just a ceremony as such, but it was something which had meaning. They did it just the two of them, as much sincerity as they could possibly muster, and they kept on doing it. When I saw her, when she did an MC for me in a talk I gave over in Kuala Lumpur some years ago, and she said that was one of the most memorable parts of her ceremony, which she still does. I thought, what a wonderful thing that is. That is giving an old rite ritual real important meaning. And so many of the rites and rituals, I'm sure that's not done when the wedding in Windsor Castle, but I think it would be wonderful if it was. But also at funeral ceremonies, because that was a personal thing. And then you all know that my father died over 50 years ago, and not being very emotionally developed at the time, that even though I never cried at my father's wedding, of course I didn't cry at his wedding, I wasn't born then, didn't cry at my father's funeral, nevertheless I felt guilty. You know, you always felt there's things you should have done which you hadn't done. I felt guilty. And you know, I remember doing this ceremony, you know, sometimes when I started seeing this happen in Thai Buddhist culture and other Buddhist cultures, and when I actually started seeing it happen, I thought maybe there was an opportunity. So I think it was by my father's death anniversary, when a lot of times we make merit for the deceased. You know, it's called sharing of merits. But it wasn't just sharing of merits. I just looked at, remembered my father as much as I could. I think it was in front of a Buddha statue to give it some more solemnity. And I said, "You know, Dad, you've been dead for a few years now, but is there anything which I've done, or did rather, body, speech or mind, which upset you? Or things which I didn't do, you know, like saying how much I loved you and so grateful for everything you did for me. Anything like that, please forgive me." And it was very powerful for me, more powerful than I expected. Because it was almost like finding something, an unfinished business, and realizing I could still finish it by, you know, doing a forgiveness ceremony to someone who had already passed away. And I tried to introduce that as often as I could into other funeral services which we perform here or in other places, to making ceremonies meaningful, which was very helpful. And seeing those little rites and rituals, so actually when you understand how they are meaningful. Oh, another little story. I haven't told this for such a long time. Over in the monastery in Sussex, in Chirthurst Monastery, there was two of my friends there. One of the friends, he was a self-made millionaire from Chicago. And, you know, after a while, you know, he realized just wealth and didn't really have much meaning for him, being there, done that, so he became a monk. He's still a monk, this fellow. And he was having an argument with another friend. I think some of the people here may remember he has been here before. His name was Ananda. He was an ex-US Marine who volunteered to join the US Army, the Marine Corps, to fight in Vietnam to get tougher. You know, he was just really just, you know, tough, aggressive, violent. But while he was in US, he got shot. He took a bullet in the back of his head. And he was lifted out on one of the choppers and taken to a military hospital. And he just thought he was going to die. And he told me it was so much pain, it didn't matter. And then that's having the operation. When he came out of the anesthetic, you know, that because he was a US Marine, supposed to be the toughest of the tough in those days, the surgeon said, you know, sorry, but, you know, when we take the bandage off, you're going to be blind because we've had to, you know, remove part of your brain, which deals with the sensory processes, the sight processes. And then he told me, and I didn't doubt this for one moment, that he said he decided that if he was blind, he was going to commit suicide. Not much point to live. And he would do that. He was tough. He knew what to do. But when the bandages were taken off, he could see. You know, doctors were surprised. He was surprised. And so he was, you know, living just on a high, a natural high for a while. And until sort of he decided to go traveling and became a monk. And it was really, really tough. But he became a really close friend of mine. You know why? It's just, we do some chanting. Actually, it fits into the talk. And the chanting in the Thai forest tradition is supposed to not be beautiful. It's supposed to be in a monotone, so that you don't sort of have any sensory desires. But he did this chant, you know, like the village monks would do. And, you know, it's very sonorous. What was it? Pravitavana metang padanta. I can't do it. I've got not a good voice. That's why I'm good at ghost chanting, because I scare the ghosts away. They can't stand my chanting. But he did it so sonorously. It was actually beautiful. It's supposed to be inviting the heavenly beings to sort of join in the ceremonies. That was the old tradition. And after he did this, the other monks, they just gave him such a scolding. That was terrible. You shouldn't do it that way. You're breaking our traditions. It's not the right way of doing it. You should know better. And he was really upset. And as we walked out, I whispered to him. And I said, if I was a heavenly being, I would come. And from that day onwards, just that little bit of just saying something nice to him. From that day onward, he was always one of my best friends. He'd always look after me and support me. And having an ex-tough US Marine looking after you really helped. But anyway, this really tough guy, when he was in England, and this other guy, who was the ex-real estate millionaire, both really tough guys, they were having an argument in the grounds of, you know, Chittos Monastery. Nose to nose, neither was going to give in. And now this was, you know, really going to look like violence. You know, in a Buddhist monastery, like, you know, really fists flying. And this would be damaged because both of them were tough guys. And then what happened was something so beautiful that the first part of it was just wonderful. It was worth it to see the result. Because, you know, fighting nose to nose, not giving in. Then the ex-Marine, who was actually senior, Ajahn Ananda, he just stopped, went down on the ground, and bowed three times to this junior monk, who was a real estate millionaire, was before, and said, please forgive me. And the real estate millionaire just started bursting out crying. I forgive you too. And they hugged and walked away as friends. It's amazing that somehow or other that little forgiveness, which was obviously sincere, totally stopped like this fight, this argument. And it didn't matter who was right and who was wrong. When there's an argument, you're both wrong. So instead, have this wonderful forgiveness. And because it was just really from the heart, it was authentic. It worked amazingly well. So those are sorts of ceremonies which, you know, that yeah, there is time just to say, oh, what are you doing the ceremonies for? Why are you going through this marriage ceremony with all the rigmarole? Why do people have to cry, you know, when people feel that they are, you know, they've lost somebody? Why do we have to go through lawyers to do divorces? You know, why do we have to take the five precepts instead of just? Sometimes I'm to blame for this because I've given the five precepts so many times. So when people say, can you give me the five precepts formally? I say, certainly. I hereby give you the five precepts. So aren't you going to do Namo Tassa and Buddhang Saranga Chami and Panati Pata where I'm anything? If you want that, just go online. It's recorded. But sometimes a bit of an iconoclast with rites and rituals. You know, because sometimes you have to have meaning to them. Have to really sort of, you know, that's why on the Waisak Day, the people actually, they get up really early in the morning. Some places over in the United States, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. And they get up early because they want to take the five precepts here online. And that is really inspiring. That, you know, I'll do the whole five precepts, you know, as clearly in beautiful Pali as possible. Because, you know, they come so far. That gives ceremonies meaning. So rites and rituals, if they're used correctly, they're very, very beautiful. But if they're just used because this is the way it was done, this is how my father did it, my grandfather, my grandfather, this is our tradition, we have to do it this way, and they don't understand why, then of course they're missing out on what these things are really for. Understand what's inside of it. So that's the old contents are more important than the containers of life. So with all the rites and rituals which are coming next week, with all the rituals and rites which we have here, please understand their meaning and then give them heart, give them goodness, give them kindness. If you do want to get married, doesn't matter what gender you are, just do it with meaning. And then, of course, I'm very happy, and other people are very happy to be here and celebrate something beautiful. Reaffirm commitments, babies, blessing, ghosts, get rid of. Look, it's quite true that here in this temple we do give before birth to after the grave service. So it's much better. Much more than many other religions. And somehow or other it works. And that's because it does mean that people get to have a feeling for something which, if you just see the rites and rituals, this is how you should chant, this is how it should be done, blah, blah, blah. I rebelled against that. Give it some meaning, give it some power, and then it's incredibly meaningful. So anyway, that's a little talk on rites and rituals and what the difference between being attached to them, just following them blindly, and actually giving them some power. And that's an example. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Do you know what it means? What does it mean? Good translation? Awesome. So let's do it in English this time, but also give it some energy, make it meaningful. If you really think it's awesome, if you don't think it's awesome, go. So, awesome, awesome. Give it one. Awesome. And just while we're waiting for the thing, you know, very good. You know that sometimes people ask me just, you know, am I breaking the rules by doing sadhu, sadhu, sadhu very loud? But you know, there was this great monk of the forest tradition. His name was Ajahn Singh Tong. And unfortunately, he died in a plane crash in 1980, I think it was. But I went to see him. And when we do the anumoda, they call anumoda the blessing. Many of you have heard this, seen this. Yata wari waha pura pari parentis, you know, just in monotone. And this monk, it was the first time, I didn't know what to do. This is how he chanted. As best I can imitate it. He start off with Yata wari waha pura pari parenti sagarang ewa mewa ito dinang peta dagupaka iji dag badito subhagiba mewa. And he was such a highly respected monk. And that just told me what rites and rituals are really about, because everybody in the village, they love that monk. And he was one of the most popular monks, and it was such a great shame that he died in this plane crash, because he would be one of these monks who would just be mega popular in any country you visited. Unconventional, but kept the rules and rituals the way the Buddha would want it. Inspiring, joyful, powerful teacher. So there's many people like that. So that is where the three big sadhus come from. I'm following a tradition. Anyway, here we go. From the Philippines, is Buddhism a religion, a science, or a philosophy? It is all three. You can make it whatever you want. As you know, the old joke, but please be careful. I've said a long time, I said this on air once, I think on Philip Adams' show. And he said, is Buddhism a religion? I say, yes, it is, for tax purposes anyway. And unfortunately, that somebody else put that in an application for some grant or whatever, and that didn't go down very well with the Department of Immigration or the ATO or whatever else. So, you know, what is actually a religion? And I think the definition in Australia, it's some belief in a supernatural. And what does that actually mean? According to the natural world, the natural philosophy, it is the five senses. You ask, no, you can't ask. Oh, you could ask Stephen Hawking now. He thinks he doesn't exist after death. But Stephen, I'm sure that, you know, you do. So if you can hear me, come and break off a leaf from the tree or something and just go and say sorry. You got it wrong. That's Stephen Hawking. But religion as science or a philosophy, it is a religion because it believes, or not doesn't believe, can find out, can explore something way beyond this world of the five senses. It is a science, very much so, because a science is willing to actually to challenge existing knowledge and take it further. It just doesn't stop in just what we thought we knew, but it is open to so many other realms of existence. It explores. It doesn't just stop with the just existing knowledge, but takes it much further. And of course, I was talking about my mate, Professor Bernard Carr, who just is actually doing that. You know, real scientists actually take it further beyond what people understand to increase our knowledge. Philosophy. Of course, it's a philosophy as well. You know, we use our logic, we use our reason, but again, we take it more than that. It certainly is a philosophy of life, and even it was, of all persons, I think Pythagoras. I read this somewhere, but haven't actually got the quote. You know, Pythagoras' theorem, but he was also a philosopher as well. Did much more than just that theorem of the square of the hypotenuse equals the sum of the squares on the two adjacent sides. Remember that one? I was a maths teacher, by the way, so I still remember some things. But anyway, he's quoted as saying he got all his philosophy from India.
interesting.
So, that would be in Buddhism at the time. So, was it a philosophy? Socrates said so. Anyway, that's for you to find out next week. It's all free. San Francisco, what is the difference between being lazy and being relaxed about your commitment? Being lazy is being selfish. It's all about you. Being relaxed about your commitment is relaxation, is a beautiful way of opening up, relaxing your body, relaxing your mind, so you can actually listen to people. It's a way of actually communicating. Instead of actually just thinking you know best, you feel what's best. So the pursuit of truth, the pursuit of goodness, and the pursuit of things like love is not for the lazy. To relax, strangely enough, takes effort. We're scared of letting go. Lastly, Hong Kong. How do you deal with frequent judgmental commentary in your mind? You try to make peace, be kind and gentle with him, her. Of course, all that commentary in the mind, that is what meditation starts to overcome. Look, I will let you into one of my little indulgences that on a Saturday morning, she actually, on our arms round, she gives us the newspaper. Oh, she's over there. The West Australian newspaper. I usually just take the comics. Honestly, I do, and that's true. And I do the cryptic crossword. Because I thought, that sort of keeps the brain active. And to do a cryptic crossword, as I was telling Ajahn Bhamani, you need a twisted mind. And last week there was one clue which I just couldn't get, and so I went to the lunch just thinking, oh crikey, what is the clue? What is the solution? And the clue was an unrepeatable performance that is personally breathtaking. And I was thinking about it, I just couldn't get it. And even, I must admit, in the lunch time, every now and again I was thinking, now what's the answer to that clue? And instead of being mindful of the food. And I could not get it. And so after lunch, just went back and did a bit of work and had to lay down. And as soon as you lay down and stop trying to think of it, the answer came up. And one of the reasons it didn't come up, because it's not a very nice word, it's like suicide. Unrepeatable experience that is personally breathtaking. I told you have to have a twisted mind to do these things. But because it's a negative thing, it's not a pleasant thing to see suicides and deal with the consequence of it. That's one of the reasons why it was hard to actually to get. But also the fact that all the thinking about it just could not penetrate it. But as soon as you stop thinking, it was one of those examples where when you stop thinking, the answer just comes up. So this is frequent judgmental commentary in your mind. The judgmental commentary will stop you seeing the truth. Don't give the judgmental commentary the dignity of being truthful. And then you see it for what it really is. Something which causes you so much problems and difficulties and just causes so many arguments and also stops you sleeping at night, causes you just to not enjoy your food when you're trying to solve the crossword puzzle instead of being mindful of your food last Saturday. I admit it. But you try to make peace, be kind, be gentle with your own mind. It's amazing just how it just brightens up, energizes and gets insights. One of the other people I'm going to talk about just very briefly, it's not just my mate Bernard Carr is investigating sort of mind on top of science, But there's another fellow, Brian Josephson. I mentioned him today at the diner, at the house blessing. Brian Josephson. He's the only Welsh man to have got the Nobel Prize in Physics. And the story behind it is, I really love this, because he was a graduate, but he's doing his PhD. He wasn't a doctor, he was just a bachelor of actually it's art. Don't explain why, it's always arts in Cambridge, not science. But anyway, that he had this breakthrough, this insight on quantum tunneling, and became the basis of the Josephson junction, which runs supercomputers, the same as the transistor effect, but this occurs at almost absolute zero temperatures. And so when he had his theory, it was regarded as rubbish by another physicist who had two Nobel Prizes for physics. Now, you know, to get one Nobel Prize is, you know, really something, but this guy had two. So what chance did this fellow, he hadn't even got a doctorate yet, of actually pressing his case against someone who had two Nobel laureates, two Nobel Prizes? But he kept on going. He just kept on just standing his ground. And eventually, the only reason I say this was because it was proved to be right. He did the experiment, and the double Nobel Prize winner had to admit he was wrong. And this Brian Josephson, that was then awarded his Nobel Prize for Physics. Wonderful, this the way he stood his ground. But also, the reason I say this is because he was a practicer of meditation, the TM meditation. And that's where he said he got his insights from, meditating. And to this day, he's got a lab in Cambridge investigating just how the mind affects the physics. And he can do that. You know, he's looked about askance by other physicists at Cambridge, but he's got his Nobel Prize. So if you've got a Nobel Prize, you can do whatever you want, basically. And that's why he's... Now, these are top scientists who are going in to breaking the rites and rituals, what you're supposed to do, what you're supposed to believe, and taking it further. Those are the people I really, really respect. They're the real scientists. Not just going over old stuff, which is like the old people, the people who would, they would go through a field of corn or hay or rice or whatever, and they call gleaning, just get a few little things which are left over. This is starting a whole new area of understanding and science. Literally just places where people haven't gone before, fields of experience which have not been investigated. And that's great to see that. So sometimes I've gone on record saying Buddhism is actually the only real science, because it doesn't stop at old knowledge. It was always willing to explore more. Interesting. Sometimes people say it's not scientific, but you're stopping exploration? Understanding? So anyway, I get into trouble for saying things like that, but I love just not being conventional. Sometimes. Anyway, there we go. So, any questions from the floor? Oh, yes, we have one from Stephen over there. He lives at Bodmin Island Monastery. He's an Anagarika. This is not a Dorothy Dixon. I didn't plant this question.
Now, Jen, you started with the royal wedding, and the bride's had a shocking week. Her father and sister were encouraged to do some stunts by the press, and they went really badly wrong. And her father ended up having heart surgery yesterday.
Yeah.
If Meghan and Harry were watching you now, what advice would you give for tomorrow, given that she's now going to be walked down the aisle by Prince Charles?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Why can't she walk down the aisle herself? I think that would be a wonderful sort of statement. I think she's 36, 37 now or something. So the idea of like being given away or having to have permission, or it's her choice who she wants to marry. And so off you go. But also, be wonderful if she doesn't need to wear a sort of a fancy dress. Wouldn't it be wonderful if she just went in just even barefoot, or in just sandals, and just something comfortable. Just maybe these jeans I see people wear with just holes in them, and just a little singlet or something. I was really disappointed that, what was that other, that Princess Mary or something, that she didn't wear traditional Australian dress. It'd be a wonderful time for a pair of sandals and thongs. Well, we have all these traditions, and so that takes all the fun out of it. You know, I'm very pleased that every now and again, people who come here, if they do have a funeral service, it's become really quite a common theme now. Sometimes they have, some people have all this very sad music, like the Titanic. You know, our love will go on. And just people just, they cry and cry, and just sometimes I think, you know, have they learned anything when they come here? But other people, they've had, you know, for those of my generation, they've had Life with Brian, Look on the Bright Side of Life. That's right, you got it. And I think, what a wonderful thing to end, you know, the person's life with fun, with joy. And it's happened that people have been whistling and dancing as we left the crematorium. And you know, sometimes I even look at the box and see if that is just twitching its feet, as in the movie. But that's the sort of thing, you know, if when I have a funeral, that's the sort of thing which I like to have be remembered as you lived. So how many people would like the life of Brian's Look on the Bright Side of Life when they die? Yeah. How many people would the Titanic sinking? Our life goes on. Anyway, I think I've said too much already, so maybe now it's the time to bow three times to the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and then we can do what we need to do afterwards. By the way, if you don't know why you have the tradition, the rites and rituals of leaving your shoes outside, is because, you know, if you think I'm not liking the royal wedding or something, it means you can't throw shoes at me. Because that's a tradition in some countries, if they don't like, it happened to George Bush and somebody else, yeah. So that's why Buddhists, especially when I'm teaching here, because I can be just quite different. You don't throw your shoes at me. Ceremony. Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantak Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangang Namami.